Ahmadinejad prompts a walkout at the United Nations. Bob Woodward writes a new book. The Librarian of Congress says that Americans still read books. But the Wall Street Journal says, not so many boys. Evangelicals experience an adoption season. And Christianity Today looks at hipster Christianity. It's Friday, September 24, 2010. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad went to the United Nations on Thursday and lambasted the United States. Offending most of those present, he went back to the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks on New York City and Washington, D.C., and suggested that there were several theories known internationally for the attacks. In one of these, he suggested that the United States government had actually conspired to arrange the attacks, using his words, to confront the declining American economy and its grips on the Middle East in order to save the Zionist regime, end quote. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has been offending international sensibilities and morality ever since he took office at the head of the repressive Iranian regime. He has been spouting this kind of conspiracy theory that blames the United States for the attacks upon itself and seeks to exonerate the Muslim world for all responsibility. But the bottom line in all of this is that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has been in New York City speaking to the United Nations because that international body affords the opportunity to crackpots like Mahmoud Ahmadinejad to spout their poison. We shouldn't be surprised that he takes the opportunity. What we see in the United Nations is what results in a Genesis 3 world after the Tower of Babel. Even as international nations gather together in an august body like the United Nations, instead of achieving peace, what so often happens is that they spill and spread international poison. The United Nations is one of those organizations that we probably do need, but we do not need it as it is, and the United Nations resists steadfastly any significant reform. The United States largely pays the bills and allows people like Mahmoud Ahmadinejad to come to New York City to spout poison such as this. Bob Woodward is out with a new book. The reporter who became so famous in the Watergate investigation, along with his partner Carl Bernstein, has become a best-selling author. His books have a certain form. The four books having to do with the Bush administration largely traced the Afghanistan and Iraq war, offering insider accounts from sources deep within the administration. His books are always interesting. They're always newsworthy. And thus, this White House, the White House of President Barack Obama, is somewhat nervous about the arrival of the book. But one thing to note about Bob Woodward's books, generally, if a president is popular, his book presents them in a very positive light. If the president is in a season of unpopularity, Woodward is more prone to present them in a less favorable light. It'll be interesting to see how this book comes out. It's entitled Obama's Wars, and this much is for sure. This will become a best-selling book, like all of Bob Woodward's previous books, offering insider accounts of American administrations. And what about the book? The Washington Post offers a column today by James H. Billington, the Librarian of Congress, in which he speaks of the 10th anniversary of the National Book Festival. In making his remarks concerning this event, the Librarian of Congress is all for books, which is hardly a surprise. But in this column, he says some things that ought to have our attention. He says, and I quote, "Why, you may ask, celebrate books at a time when everything is going digital? Certainly the book business is in a transitional state like all print media, but books are not going away. New technologies tend to supplement rather than supplant older ones. Television did not destroy radio. The VCR and DVD players did not keep people away from movie theaters. While the technologies we use to read books may change, the value of reading them does not. And the values of the book culture that helped create our nation must not be left behind. In an era of 140-character messages and the increasing destruction of the basic unit of civilized discourse, the sentence, it is critical that we continue to encourage the production and reading of books." Well said, Mr. Librarian. Books are important, and the reading of books is essential to civilization. I like what Librarian of Congress James Billington said about the sentence as the basic unit of civilized discourse. We are in a sad shape as a civilization if we do reduce all of our communication to 140-character messages or to the kind of digital speak that now poses for real communication and language amongst many people, especially the young. It's a good thing that Americans do still read, and it's also a good thing that the Librarian of Congress recognizes that the technology of the book will and does change. It's changing before our eyes as people are carrying around not only books, but also Kindles, iPads, and other digital reading devices. The book will indeed survive. Indeed, I am confident that the Codex, the printed book with covers, will survive, but many books will be read in ways that the authors of those books, the publishers of ages past, could never have expected. Well, if Americans are still reading, and if the book still has a cherished place in American culture, the same might not be said for boys. Studies indicate that boys are falling behind girls in reading proficiency at virtually every age. And once boys reach the anticipated normal age of reading literacy, many of them simply opt out and play video games and watch video entertainment, lose themselves in a digital world, and hardly ever read a book. Thomas Spence, writing in today's edition of the Wall Street Journal, suggests that it's a good thing that many parents and educators have caught on to the fact that boys are not reading and that it is a problem. The bad news, he says, is that many of those who are concerned have perfectly awful ideas for solving it. I quote from his article, "Everyone agrees that if boys don't read well, it's because they don't read enough. But why don't they read? A considerable number of teachers and librarians believe that boys are simply bored by the stuffy literature they encounter in school. According to a revealing Associated Press story in July, these experts insist that we must meet them where they are, that is, pander to boys' untutored tastes." Mr. Spence doesn't want to pander to those tastes. He believes that boys can be taught to read the old-fashioned way, by turning off electronic devices and leaving boys in the presence of books. They will actually pick them up and read them. And about their tastes, well, if you know the background to this, you might have visited a local bookstore and see that many of the books that are directed towards boys, supposedly with the interest of getting them to read, are actually about issues that are fairly grotesque, basic, and not very helpful to the character formation of boys. This is not to suggest that boys should read books for girls. It's not to suggest that boys should stay away from the issues and objects of their interest. As a matter of fact, boys were generally led to read in ages past through adventure stories, historical accounts, and the kinds of books that lead boys to imagine the events and the characters in their own lives. C.S. Lewis, citing both Aristotle and Plato, speaking of, for instance, boys, said this, "The little human animal will not at first have the right responses. It must be trained to feel pleasure, liking, disgust, and hatred at those things which really are pleasant, likable, disgusting, and hateful." End quote. Well, if you have one of those little human animals in your house, you might think about doing what actually leads them to read the kind of books that you would want them to read. The Associated Press story mentioned by Mr. Spence drops a clue to the problem when it describes the effort of one set of parents with their 13-year-old son who doesn't like to read. Quote, "They've tried bribing him with new video games," end quote. Well, that's hardly the solution. How about taking the video games away, allowing only limited use? How about turning the machines off and suggesting to the boy that he read because you're telling him to read? That's old-fashioned. Many people would say it's autocratic, but that's the way most of us actually learned to read and learned to love reading and actually became readers. Naomi Schaefer Riley is writing in the Wall Street Journal today in the Houses of Worship column about what she calls the adoption season for evangelicals. She's hardly alone in noting the increased and passionate interest of many evangelicals in the adoption of children, the adoption of babies, the adoption of older children, domestic adoptions, and international adoptions. There is a deep and important theological impulse here, and this is becoming a part of major focus in ministry for many churches, especially in the evangelical world. She writes about a biblical mandate to help children, especially those in foster care, undertaken by ministries such as Focus on the Family through their Wait No More program. She cites the July cover story in Christianity Today, which also was about this evangelical renaissance in adoption ministry. That issue included a feature by Dr. Russell Moore, my colleague and dean of the School of Theology at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, author of the book, Adopted for Life. In it, he recounts the adoption of his own children, as he and his wife adopted two boys from Russia. But in a far deeper way, he takes us into the theological and biblical logic of adoption and ties it to the gospel and offers very real-life advice for parents considering adoption and for churches sponsoring and encouraging adoption ministries. It's important that Naomi Schaefer Riley has seen this pattern and written about it in the Wall Street Journal. We can only hope that those who read her article come to understand that it is about the children and it is about adoption, but it's ultimately about the gospel. Ms. Riley makes a very interesting statement. I quote, "All of this makes the growing evangelical interest in adoption seem particularly countercultural. With the widespread availability of artificial reproductive technologies, such as in vitro fertilization, many couples who previously would have chosen adoption can now use surrogates, donor sperm, or donor eggs to have a baby who shares their DNA, or whose DNA they have carefully chosen, and whose parental care they can closely monitor. Taking a child as he or she comes to you may be a difficult choice for some parents to make these days," end quote. But that difficult choice is all about children who are very much in need of parents, in need of adoption, in need of families, in need of love. And that is why this issue is of such importance, and evangelicals are experiencing an adoption season. Christianity Today's cover story in the current issue is about what it calls hipster Christianity. It offers a cover story by Brett McCracken, which is based on his book by the same title. The interesting thing about this article is that Brett McCracken takes us into the logic of this new generational movement in American evangelicalism. It's an effort to be cool. Now, as he notes, just about every generation of young evangelicals has sought in their own way to be cool. But this pattern of acculturated, calculated cool comes with some complications and some controversies. Writing in the cover story, Mr. McCracken says, "The latest incarnation of a decades-long collision of cool and Christianity, hipster Christianity, is in large part a rebellion against the very subculture that birthed it. It's a rebellion against old-school evangelicalism and its fuddy-duddy legalism, apathy about the arts, and pitiful lack of concern for social justice." He goes on and writes, "The new subculture of young evangelicals, I call them Christian hipsters, grew up on contemporary Christian music, focus on the family's adventures in Odyssey, flannel graphs, vacation Bible school, and hysteria about the end times. Now all of that is laughable to them as they attempt to burn away the kitschy dross of megachurch Christianity of their youth, with its emphasis on soul winning at the expense of everything else, and trade it for something with real world gravitas," end quote. Now, that's a rather insightful analysis of this new hipster Christianity, and Brett McCracken writes with some sympathy, but also with the keen eye of a critic. I think the most significant thing about his article, and I'll be taking a closer look soon at his book, is the fact that he contrasts the cool hipster Christianity of this generation with that of the young people of the 70s. He goes back and mentions that for the young people of the 70s, their big problem was how much worldliness they needed to leave behind in order to become faithful followers of Jesus Christ. In a very perceptive insight, he says that the real issue for the hipster Christianity of the present is how much worldliness they can now embrace without forfeiting their Christian witness and Christian faithfulness. An interesting question, a good cover story in the current issue of Christianity Today. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. You'll find a wealth of resources at my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/albertmohler. You'll also find a great deal about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary by going to our website at sbts.edu. I want to make sure you know about Boyce College Preview Day. If you're a young person considering college, or the parent or friend of a young person considering college, I hope you'll make sure they know about this special day, October 22, 2010. Boyce College Preview Day allows you to come to the campus and gain the most intensive firsthand understanding of what's really going on. I'm very proud of this college, its faculty, its students, and its programs. I hope you'll come to visit and see what it's all about. You'll find out more by going to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you on Monday for The Briefing.